right, everyone, we're going to get started so we maximize our time with our speaker. I know others will join us as soon as the 9 o'clock service is completely done. Good morning, everybody. I think you know me. I'm Clark Irvin. Thank you so much for being here. We're so pleased today to welcome as our speaker, Christopher Brown, who is the director of the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, which is Washington's most popular museum. Chris joined the museum in 2017 as its deputy director, and he became its director 5 years later in 2022. Among his many responsibilities as director is exhibiting and preserving the museum's collection of some 60,000 aviation and aerospace artifacts, which are on display either in the Museum on the Mall or in satellite facilities in Virginia and Maryland. Before that, Chris had a couple of fascinating careers, as if the current career is not fascinating enough. He is a decorated naval aviator. He's a graduate of the Navy's Top Gun Fighter Weapon School. And over the course of his 7 years of active service in the Navy, he amassed more than 1,400 flight hours and more than 300 carrier landings. That is tough to top. After that, for 7 years, he managed not only Ronald Reagan Washington Airport, but also Dulles Airport. He earned a BA in history from Dartmouth and a Master of Science degree in aeronautics from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. And he's also the senior warden of his parish in Virginia. And he told me that he spent nearly all of yesterday, perhaps all of yesterday, literally in a parish retreat. And to that I said, I can relate to that. He's joined by his wife, Mary Beth. And with that, please join me in welcoming Chris Brown. Thank you so much, Chris.
Well, thank you, Clark, and thank you for this wonderful invitation. I'm always mindful that our time is perishable and we can't get it back. And so the fact that you've chosen to spend your time this morning is an honor, and I hope to make it worth your while. I should also note, Clark, that in addition to my wife, Mary Beth, I wanted to call out Marion Blakey, who has served on our board for a number of years and continues to do so. So thank you, Marion. You could probably give this brief yourself. But it's truly a privilege to join you and share a few thoughts and make sure that we have time for question. And I said to Mary Beth, if I go long, you give me the start your engine sign, which means wrap it up. So if you see her doing that, that means I've gone long. But I certainly welcome the questions. And in the event there are questions after we adjourn, I can leave you my card and be available. We will join for the 11 o'clock service, because as I told our rector yesterday, I won't be at the commissioning of the vestry today because I'll be at another church. But it's really a privilege to be here. So I thought I'd start off with a slide that may seem a little odd. And does anybody recognize this?
Memorex.
And Memorex stands for Memory Excellence. So some of us remember this as an advertisement back in the 70s. And it's really operative because the person in the chair has sunglasses on. And he's listening to music coming through a speaker. His sense of reality is being challenged. And so, in fact, the tagline, next slide, became, is it real or is it Memorex? And this idea of truth in our lives and when can we really discern truth, it's part of the reason I think we come to church. But it's also something we at the Smithsonian and other museums contend with. But let's use another example. Next slide. So, Top Gun. Tom Cruise, I actually think he's aged quite well. But the picture on the upper left is a scene from the Top Gun movie in the 80s, where we're asked to believe that he's flying an F-14 Tomcat. And the picture on the lower right is almost four decades later. He's in an F-18 in the sequel, Top Gun Maverick. Also, we're being led to believe he's flying that aircraft. So I ask you, is he airborne in either of these photographs? Or even more so, is he the pilot? Is he actually flying that aircraft? That's what he wants us to believe, but what do we think? What do we know? The truth, next slide. Sorry, spoiler alert, Top Gun, the original movie, not so real. He was in a cockpit, but it wasn't airborne. The screen behind him was a green screen, and then we were led to believe, because they could shake it, that in fact he was flying aircraft. But the aircraft that were being flown in that first movie were all being flown by Navy pilots, many of whom I knew personally, having gone through the school, and they in fact were my instructors at the time. But next slide, what about Top Gun Maverick? Is he, well, let's just start saying, is he airborne in this picture?
Yes,
he is. Not the pilot, but he is airborne. And why did Tom Cruise want to do this? Why did he want to go to the effort and the expense in convincing the Navy that he and the other actors had to be in the aircraft actually flying? Because he wanted us to believe. He wanted us to see this as real, even to the point when they're pulling high G's, you can see their face kind of peel back. But he wasn't the pilot. In fact, side story, the pilot who was in the front seat flying them, a guy named Frank Weezer. And a quick story, he was Tom Cruise's pilot for the filming. And at one point, the producer for Paramount Pictures came to him and said, well, Tom, what's it, or he said, Frank, what's it like to be a stand-in for Tom Cruise? And Frank thought for a moment, he said, wait a minute, this is what I do, he's a stand-in for me. But I think this question of what's real, what's truthful, what can we believe, what does it mean to be authentic, next slide, is really at the core of museums at large, and it certainly is for the Smithsonian. We live in an age, we all know, where skepticism, disbelief is to the point of fracturing, I would suggest, our society, and creating doubt to the point that people don't know what to believe. And then you introduce AI, which is some would see as a scary thing, and to the point where I don't know whether that stunt's real. I don't know if that voice is real. I don't even know if the person on the other end of the phone is real. And yet, it's a real challenge, but it's one that the museums hold dear, and particularly at the Smithsonian, because we are collectively, and certainly the Smithsonian, among the most trusted institutions in our society, second only to family and friends. And you wonder, like, why is that? And it's because We try to be fact-based and present real and authentic objects, original objects, that are research oriented. But we know that trust once lost is hard to regain. And so I provide this context because it's not just true at the museum I account for and lead, but it's true throughout the Smithsonian and all museums, is how do we remain that place of authenticity in our society when so many other trusted, formerly trusted institutions are no longer have that privilege. The next slide speaks to trust in a way. Some of you may remember this tagline, and it's one I use with our staff and our team, that trust is earned. It cannot be assumed, it's not given, and it can be lost. And so I always loved this tagline from Eastern that said, we have to earn our wings every day. Never mind the fact they went bankrupt. It's still a good tagline that I think I'm reminded of myself as sort of a guiding principle. We earn this trust. And so what does that mean for the Smithsonian Institution? Next slide, please. I'm going to assume that many of you are local, that this is your parish, your residence of this area. Some may be visiting. What we have here in our neighborhood, in our backyard, is a national treasure of unparalleled proportion, and we sometimes forget that. The Smithsonian is the largest museum system in the world, 21 museums, 9 research centers, 21 libraries, 6,000 employees, cutting-edge research being done all over the world. And the museums are open every day of the year except for Christmas, and importantly, are free, which is really fascinating because we have international visitors coming in trying to pay our volunteers, saying, well, I got to pay somewhere. It's like, no, this is our nation's gift to itself and to the world, saying, this is our DNA, this is who we are, and this is what we celebrate, and in so doing, do so truthfully. So the next slide speaks more to the context of air and space. National Air and Space Museum, as Clark mentioned, several facilities. The one we think of most readily is the museum on the National Mall, opened in 1976, again as a gift to the nation from the nation on the occasion of its 200th anniversary. Michael Collins, the command pilot from the Apollo 11 mission, was its first director. An incredibly successful museum for four decades. Over 300 million visitors, making it among the most visited museums in the world, and certainly the most visited aerospace museum in the world, and the most visited Smithsonian Museum. We also have a facility out next to Dulles, the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center. It's the only Smithsonian property that's been built entirely with private philanthropy. The story of Steve Hazy and his family is a remarkable one, save for another day, but that is a gift of true proportion. And then we have the Paul Garber facility in Maryland, which has housed much of the collection since the end of World War II, but over time we are moving the collection to our state-of-the-art facilities at the Udvar-Hazy Center. So I thought I'd take a few moments to touch on the work going on the National Mall, which some of you may be familiar with. Next slide. And to do so, let me use this sort of diagram. You're looking at this as if you were on Independence with the Capitol to the right. And the this is a section of the museum as it was built in 76. And without getting into a lot of background as to the why, suffice it to say the museum structure wore out as a consequence of a number of things, not the least being the visitation. So in many ways, this project is a consequence of its incredibly successful past. And that project, of course, is to rebuild the entire structure. And this means taking the stone off, and when the stone came off, we exposed the interior of the building, which necessitated the removal of artifacts. So we had to, over what will ultimately be a 10-year project, and we're well through it, be a two-phase project where we take this, we are taking the, and have the building down to its bare steel. And sort of like Phoenix out of the ashes, rebuilding anew. And the light portion to the left of the photograph is the west end of the museum that has since been reopened to great success. We are actually using a free ticketing system, but timed entry allows us to provide predictability to our guests and also ensure that we don't oversubscribe the building either for an from the experience perspective, but also the egress, at least until we have the full building open. But it's necessitated the removal of all the artifacts over the course of the project, most of which have gone back over to Udvar-Hazy Center for restoration. Mammoth project, and the cost reflects it. Once again, the citizens of the nation, as a gift to itself, are financing $729 million of federal financing for this project. But importantly, it's the building that it finances. The storytelling, everything within, arguably the key touch point of the museum, is done entirely philanthropically. And that is $285 million. And you may have noticed, I go by the title of John and Adrian Marr's director. It is through their generosity that my position, for instance, is endowed. But it's through individual corporate generosity, people who believe in what we're doing, who have stepped up to help finance arguably the most important part of this project. Some have said, well, it's a $1 billion project. I don't like to say that because that sounds really big, and it is really big, but that's the reality. About 25% of the cost of the project is philanthropic and about 3/4 through the citizens' generosity. So the next slide, how does this play out? What does it look like? Well, if you're on the National Mall, looking back at the main entrance, the most obvious new feature, and it's actually built now, it's not yet open, the second phase will open in the summer of 26, but it's an awning, if you will, that allows visitors to come in, divest, screen, revest, get oriented before they even enter the museum and what is arguably one of our signature galleries, the Boeing Milestones of Flight Hall. So a lot of features and enhancements to the building that will give it a 100-year life. And it's not trite to say it is truly better than new, but at considerable effort and expense. But inside, next slide please, is really where we have impact with our visitors, whomever they are, however they present, wherever they come from. And this is sort of a quick view of eight galleries and the entrance off of Independence. And time doesn't permit me to go into the detail of every gallery. I certainly invite you to come visit. You can, in fact, get a much deeper dive off our website. But let me, for a moment, to the next slide, highlight one of those galleries, and that is Destination Moon. And as we started to rebuild these galleries anew, you always start with the why. Why do it? Now, when the museum opened in 76, the story of Apollo, it wasn't even history, it was practically a current event. But today, the people going into this gallery, the vast, vast majority, were not alive during Apollo. So why do we tell the story of Apollo? What's its relevance? Now, some people remember the old movie Capricorn 1 that created all this doubt that Neil Armstrong, oh, they never went to the moon. It gets back to that truth piece. You know, this is the spacesuit that Neil Armstrong walked on the moon with. That is the space capsule that took Neil, Buzz, and Mike to lunar orbit in July of 1969. We can say that. That's factual. But it gets back to the why. Why tell this story? Other than the fact it's a lot of cool artifacts, it's really a momentous occasion. But the why to me really comes down to four elements. And the play out in this gallery that is sort of a life story that I think we take today with us. And that is the four elements. When you think of Apollo, for me, I think of the speech that President Kennedy gave at Rice University. Early 60s, he said, we're going to send a man to the moon, time being that it was, and return him safely to Earth, which arguably was the hardest part of the mission, before the end of the decade, as he said, the Bostonian decade. And I think of the engineers, like my wife, who's a structural engineer, sitting in the audience saying, what is he talking about? We can barely get off the launch pad. We know nothing about orbital mechanics, nothing. I mean, what a crazy vision. But as Kennedy said, if we're going to do the hard things, we must be bold. So it starts, big things start with a vision. Apollo had that. It starts with resource, the second element I'd suggest. 400,000 Americans, billions of dollars in the national treasury at a time, a very difficult time in this nation's history when there were a lot of competing needs. There's a commitment of a resource. The other thing, the third I would argue, is a tolerance for risk. Tragically, one could argue that the Apollo fire, the Apollo 1 fire that killed Chafee, Grissom, and White, is what allowed us to succeed, because the entire capsule was redesigned as a consequence of that fatal, terrible day in a way that led to success. And that plays out through aviation and the space history. You have to have a tolerance for risk. And by the way, risk isn't only human risk. The James Webb telescope that is now looking at light within 300 million years of the universe's formation, and I do think there's a theological piece to that story. That's like being in the infirmary as the child is being born. We are now seeing incredible things from a telescope that is a million miles away. There were 344 single point failures on that. I think Apollo had 80. And what is a single point failure? If that failure occurs, the mission is completely lost. There's no workaround, there's no salvage. The risk is that we easily could have had a $10 billion piece of space junk a million miles away without any hope of repair. That's risk, that's tolerance for risk. And the fourth element, I think, is human ingenuity, our ability to solve problems, and we often forget that. And I love, being neither scientist nor engineer, I love the collision that occurs between it, where the scientist, the geologist says, we need to pick up that rock on the surface of Mars for this reason, for the science, and turns to the engineers and say, figure it out, get me there. That grind, that's where human ingenuity plays out. And this argument that AI is going to replace that, I don't subscribe to. But it seems to me those four elements that we celebrate in this gallery, vision, resource, a tolerance for risk, human ingenuity, when you combine that, you go to the moon. You cure cancer. You solve climate change. So to me, this story is as relevant today as it was when it unfolded 50 years ago. So that's part of why we are doing what we do. But it's also, if I may go to the next slide, given us an opportunity to not just regress to the way we were and rebuild the building the way it was. 40% of the artifacts in the building are now coming in for the first time. Some have said, well, Chris, you're being revisionist with stories. I said, no. In many cases, we're broadening the story. In this case, this is a picture of that Milestones, Boeing Milestones of Flight Hall Gallery, and the orange aircraft is what Chuck Yeager flew in 1947 and broke the sound barrier, the first person to do so. Epic, huge, will always be a story to be told. That aircraft is going to get returned into that hall as we rebuild it here in the coming months. So it's not a question of diminishing Chuck Yeager's story, but if we go to the next slide, the opportunity we've had with this project is to broaden the story. So in this case, what you're looking at is a T-38 supersonic jet trainer, a ubiquitous aircraft flown by thousands of pilots in many nations of the world, and also our astronauts. But why this aircraft? This is one of those 40% artifacts in the building for the first time. It's been in the National Collection in storage over at the Maryland facility for decades. Why did we bring it in? Jackie Cochran, perhaps not a household name, was the first woman to break the sound barrier, set 8 world records in that airframe, in that aircraft, world and speed and altitude. She set more world she had more world records when she died than any man alive, including Chuck Yeager. And in fact, 37 of those records are still on the books. So you look at this and you say, what's its provenance? Well, I think the provenance is there. It tells the story. But we haven't done it at the expense of Chuck Yeager and the Bell X-1. But what we are able to do is expand the story of supersonic flight beyond the lens of a military white guy like me or Chuck, so that maybe, just maybe, a young girl will come look at that aircraft and see the possibilities. And I'll leave you with one other example where this plays out, because you really do have to be intentional about this. But you have to be truthful, you have to be authentic, because when we have our visitors come in, they have to know that what they're seeing and what they believe is in fact true. So in this case, next slide please. This aircraft greets you as you come in the entrance off of Independence. The Eric Sloan mural behind us, beautiful piece of artwork, original to the building, is remaining in the building, but now for the first time in front of it is an aircraft that we accessioned into the collection, the National Collection, about 5 years ago. Why this aircraft? You know, space is limited. Why do we tell this story? Well, a little bit behind the story. This aircraft actually was hand-built by a guy named Neil Loving, also not a household name. Neil Loving, an African-American in 1948, tried to join the Civil Air Patrol. He was denied by virtue of his race. So he said, I'll form my own all-black Civil Air Patrol squadron, which he did. Tragically, he lost both his legs in a glider accident. But undeterred, he became the first licensed pilot to fly with 2 prosthetics and the first licensed air racer. He didn't just fly, he went on to race. He had an illustrious career as an aeronautical engineer with the Air Force at Wright-Patterson for many years. And as if that wasn't enough, he designed and hand-built his own aircraft, including this one, which he has 700 flight hours in. But this isn't just any aircraft. It's kind of like the Navy aircraft because the wings fold. He would design it so the wings fold. And if you looked at the tail, he would hook it to the trailer ball on the back of his truck and tow it to a field, unfurl the wings, and go flying. 700 hours. I mean, that's a story with provenance. That's why we now tell the story for the first time in this museum. And maybe, just maybe, a young child of color coming in will look at that, see him or herself in that story, and believe. It's all about trust and creating that opportunity for awe and inspiration. Let me close with just two quick slides because I know we're coming up. I don't quite have the things yet. But when I joined the Smithsonian, next slide please, I immediately noted my email address was si.edu. We are a place of education. That is the core of what we do. We're trying to change lives, impact, awe, inspiration through educational efforts. And we do it in multiple ways. You know, the interesting thing about COVID is it did force us, like many, to pivot into the digital space much more rapidly than we otherwise would have. We have far more digital visitors now than we do in person. So we're really able to expand. But how do we really expand that educational opportunity? Well, we're the recipients of a very substantial gift from Jeff Bezos, who found his inspiration at this Air Museum. He could have given to anywhere else, but he chose the Air and Space Museum because it changed him, as it has many people, myself included, when I first visited in 1977. But in any event, as a parallel but separate project on the end of the building closest to the Capitol, which used to be a restaurant, we are now in design of the Bezos Learning Center, where we will be able to take to scale our teaching programs for students, for teachers, for adults, lifelong learning, and be able to scale within the Smithsonian and beyond in ways otherwise not possible. So this is now in final review by the National Capital Planning Commission and others, great partners we're working with, and we will be going to 35% design at the end of later this year, and this we expect to be in service and operational spring of 27. A parallel project to the one I just reviewed, but a very, very critical one for which we're grateful. And then lastly, this last slide is of the Phoebe Waterman Haas Observatory. Now you wouldn't think, you'd think the only way you can look into the heavens is to come to St. John's, but actually there is an observatory on the mall that will provide that opportunity, again, through the generosity of a wonderful friend of the museum, a real patriot and friend of the nation, and that's Tom Haas and his family. But it's going to allow us to provide the observation of the sun during the day, carefully, but then, of course, the night sky for many audiences that rarely may look up and remind themselves of what's above. So on that note, let me wrap up, and I don't know if there's time for questions. I don't want to make anybody late for the 11 o'clock service. I'll be attending with Mary Beth as well, but Clark, has been a privilege. I enjoyed this, and I'm available for questions. Thank you. That's a great question. The question is the criteria on artifact selection that goes in the museum on the mall as opposed to the one on at the Varhazy Center next to Dulles. It's a great question. If you've been to the two facilities, they complement each other but are quite different. On the mall, we have galleries like the one I just described with intentional storytelling, a sort of a timeline. And artifact selection very much starts with the story, and that's something I've appreciated. What is the story you want to tell? Now, we're going to have a number of galleries opening, for instance, World War II Gallery, for which we can't have the Enola Gay by virtue of its size. And so in some cases, size prevents us from showcasing or introducing a particular artifact here in the mall. But ultimately, it's the storyline that we're trying to tell that determines, that drives the artifact selection.
So you're doing it chronologically?
It depends. I mean, when we looked at these galleries, we said, what are the storylines we want to talk about? In early flight, the Apollo era, living in the space age. You know, we're now in what is arguably the golden age of space. Many of us understand the golden age of aviation, 1930s and Barnstorming. The golden age of space is unfolding before us right now. And so one of the things we're trying to do is introduce artifacts that are contemporary, that people are seeing right now.
Thank you.
whether it's off an Artemis mission or what, others. And so it starts with a story. We pick from the artifacts we have. We borrow many. We have some on loan, just as we loan other artifacts. And in some cases, the story, we would want very much to introduce an artifact that by virtue of its size or otherwise we can't. But the Udvar-Hazy Center in its own way is just a national treasure as well. But I think fundamentally it starts with the storyline. What is the story we're trying to tell, yes, ma'am?
What sort of role do you see these sort of billionaire space projects playing in conjunction with sort of NASA's space role, aeronautics space? So Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos and so on, what with their sort of personal billionaire projects, what sort of, how do you see them dovetailing with NASA's research projects?
So I think one way to say it, if I may, is sort of this nexus between private money and NASA's efforts, and are they aligned and how do they align? You know, far, far, far more satellites are being lifted, launched commercially than through government efforts. And I guess I would equate it to something akin to a public-private partnership, where NASA is partner to many, many, many missions. The Webb Telescope, Northrop Grumman, others played a huge role, but clearly NASA as well. And so I think if Administrator Nelson were here, he would say, you know, NASA's role has not been eclipsed, I would argue, by the growth in commercial spaceflight. In some ways, it's been enhanced and even more important, made more important, because some of this activity has to be prioritized, some of it conflicts. And so I don't know if that was perhaps some of the thinking, but I don't see NASA's role being diminished as a result of this. I think it's going to be enhanced, just like the FAA's role is going to be enhanced as we get into further electric flight, pilotless flight, and so forth. So I think some of these government agencies that we've set up to help broker, establish, and lead us into these new frontiers are going to remain absolutely relevant. Yes, ma'am?
With the airplane that Neil Lubin made, do you ever have him come to the museum and talk about his possession?
So the question is whether Neil Loving, if we've invited him to talk, tell his story. Sadly, Neil, he is deceased. But it's an excellent point, because we try very hard to bring in, we have a very robust speaker series where we will bring in not just subject matter experts, but people who actually lived, built, flew, designed much of what we're talking about. And you know, getting that oral history is arguably every bit as important, in some ways more important than the artifact itself.
I'm sorry, do you know if a book was written?
There's been, we can get you some information. And then there's also the back end, our blog has much deeper dive on his story, just as it does Chuck Yeager's and Jackie Cochran and other. And it gets back to that point of education. Yes, sir. I didn't hear all that. I apologize. To becoming a member of the Air and Space Society? Well, I did not plant that question. So we have now 35,000 people who believe strongly enough in what we're doing to now become part of the National Air and Space Society. You can become a member for $35 a year, and we certainly invite more robust participation if that is of your liking. But one of the things that you do receive as being a NAS member, as we say, are four issues per year of our Airspace Quarterly, which quite there, thank you. It is a homespun periodical that we do for the benefit of our NAS members, but we do make it available digitally soon after it's released in its hard copy form for our members. Way that is unique from its predecessor in the past is it's entirely published internal to the museum. So you're going to see stories in there that really relate directly to the museum, but also the world we're in. I'm very proud of that publication. We could spend more time on it. Thank you for highlighting that. But among other things, that's one of the benefits you receive. Yes, sir.
Maybe you could get a little bit further into telling a story, because it's not always as simple. I'm thinking of the Adola Gay, where, you know, is the story, this ended World War II, or this killed 100,000 people?
Well, it's...
And as I recall, there was a big debate about that when it was originally shown.
And that is the nature of so much what the Smithsonian, ourselves included, display. And I think what I try to remind myself is it's not for me to judge what you think leaving or what you conclude. My duty is to introduce the aircraft and its role in the war. On our blog, for instance, you will get a deeper dive, and it'll describe the number of people killed as a consequence of that of the bomb on Hiroshima. We don't say whether it was the right action or wrong action, good or otherwise. If we're doing our job well, we equip you with those facts to allow you to make that conclusion yourself. And it plays out in many of our storylines. But it would be a mistake not to display it because it had a past that was perhaps controversial, let's just say. I've had people say, why do you show aircrafts with Nazi insignias on them? Well, that was the history, and it's our duty to describe that history as accurately as we can and leave to others to determine and judge as to whether these were the right decisions or the wrong decisions or the right use or the wrong use. Yes, sir.
Thank you so much for coming. Wonderful talk. You've got a lot of roof space, renewable energy. You've got a lot of space to heat in the winter as well as cool in the summertime. Any predictions for renewable energy?
Well, yes. A couple things on that. A lot of the roof is actually glass, which was a great design element for artifacts, not so good. And so we've replaced all that glass with stronger glass, fritted glass, and are actually putting in shades to protect artifacts. And in so doing, we've reduced the energy load in the building by 40%. The other thing, though, that's interesting is we are now capturing all the rainwater off those roofs into 200,000-gallon cisterns. That water feeds all our commodes, all the landscaping, such that we've now reduced the water we demand from the city by 88%. And so there's more to do in this regard, just as there is in our exhibits, but we've really tried to be very intentional. Putting solar panels on the roof in the design of that building was not feasible. But we've tried to make up for it in other ways. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the Golden Age of space, and there are some stories that are still unfolding in the aviation and space world. Even the move to a more net zero kind of future with sustainable airline fuel and whatnot. How are you leaving space in the exhibits to tell the unfolding story that's kind of happening around us?
That's a great question, because I think for too long people have thought of the Smithsonian as the nation's attic, and they think of the Ark of the Covenant over natural history, you know. Somewhere it's over there, I guess. I saw it in Raiders of the Lost Ark. We want to be retrospective and tell the history, but to be relevant, we need to be prospective. We need to be contemporary. Some of the way we do it is through our digital, our multimedia, but galleries need to be refreshed. So we have a gallery called Innovations. Alan and Shelley Holt contributed generously for a gallery that allows us to rotate exhibits through every 18 months. The first exhibit is going to be on climate change. How is our industry introducing carbon? But importantly, so many of the solutions we believe are going to generate, just like the Apollo story through those four elements, from people coming through the museum. So we see aerospace and aviation as being a source of solution for, I don't know what they're going to be, hydrogen fuel or otherwise. But the second gallery is going to be on electric VTOL, advanced air mobility. And then the third one down the road I want to do is on AI. what's the implication in aerospace? It's profound, and I would argue in many good ways, but that's one way we're able to stay current and relevant. So, and I think we're running out of time.
We've got 3 minutes, so okay. If there's one more quick question, a quick answer will be presented.
Yes, thank you for being here this morning. What's your top two or three acquisition wish list items and why?
Oh my gosh. Well, some of them, the Air Force is upset with me because I've been acquiring Navy aircraft, it seems. But, you know, some of the F-15 Eagle that's still in service is arguably the best fighter of its type ever built, without doubt. And there's some in the Air Force inventory that have particular provenance. We're working with them, and when it comes off duty, that's an aircraft. The 117 stealth aircraft, that's on our list. We've got an airframe that we would like to accession into the collection. The problem is it's becoming, Lockheed and the Air Force are having to remove so much of it because it's still classified. And from a museum perspective, at some point, it's just like, I don't want to tell the public this is that aircraft in its entirety. But there's a tipping point there. We're working with them. But certainly some of those. And then on the space side, you know, NASA and Artemis and Blue Origin. One of the interesting things in the commercial space sector is their potential artifacts don't naturally come to the Air and Space Museum as NASA gives us right of first refusal. So we have to work with those. And I'll just close by one example. The ISS space station is supposed to deorbit in 2030. There's a lot of stuff up there that we want in the collection that need to tell that story rather than have it all burn up. So we're actually talking with some of the providers saying, you know, Sierra Space, can you bring some stuff back with it? And so I've actually talked to the administrator, Bill Nelson, about that. I said, it's going to disappear if we don't do something. So we're museums, we're always collecting. Thank you.
Please join me.
Thank you very much.